Welcome once again to the Disability News Program here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Thank you for tuning in. On the program today, I'll be reading stories related to disability issues from a number of sources, including NBC News, the Iowa Capital Dispatch, the Braille Monitor, the Disability Scoop, and more. To begin, from the Savvy Scoop, we have information on some summer programs at Savvy. So summer is right around the corner. Nothing beats a cold glass of lemonade by the pool during an Arizona summer. But once school's out and your free time feels endless, what's next? Well, summer is always a buzzing time here at Savvy. As the season approaches, we gear up by reaching out to our community and prepping for one of our favorite annual traditions, summer camp. That's right, Savvy's summer camp is back, and we're excited to create another incredible experience for blind youth of all ages. Our summer program is all about building non-visual skills, empowering students through advocacy, and fostering independence. From young kids to teens, our campers learn what it means to be confident, capable, and connected members of their community. First up, we have Reaching Empowerment and Achievement Through Learning. Keep it real. Savvy Services for the Blind is excited to offer several options during the summer for students of all ages at each of our training centers. Our summer programs are designed to provide blind youth with a fun and engaging experience to prevent summer learning loss through hands-on activities in science, technology, engineering, and math. They will strengthen their critical thinking, problem solving, and independence while developing non-visual skills such as reading Braille, navigating with a white cane, using access technology, and mastering daily life skills. Campers will have the chance to go on outings, try new activities, and make new friends. They'll gain confidence, explore the world around them, and have fun while preparing for future success in the upcoming school year and beyond. If you are interested in learning more about our summer programming, please visit www.savvy.us. That's www.saavi.us. Or reach out to us at getsavvy@savvy.us. That's getsavvy@saavi.us. Now here's a little bit more information about some of the specific programs. A program called STEM2U. NFB STEM2U brings a full day of accessible STEM lessons and activities to blind youth, providing non-visual tools and techniques that help students of all ages across the country explore and pursue STEM education and careers. STEM2U takes place from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. with lunch provided. That's June 21st, 2025, and it'll take place in Tucson. NFB Bell Academy. We are proud to once again host the National Federation of the Blind Braille Enrichment for Literacy and Learning Academy at our Phoenix and Tucson training centers. This incredible learning experience is a nationwide summer program that prepares blind and low vision children to grow into confident and independent blind people who live the lives they want. Although it is designed for children ages 4 through 12, Arizona's Bell Academy can make exceptions on a case-by-case basis. Children should attend who do not receive enough Braille and non-visual skills instruction in school, could benefit from more Braille exposure over the summer, would enjoy connecting with other blind and low-vision children, would like the opportunity to learn from blind role models. In addition to Braille crafts, games, and other engaging projects, children learn vital independent living skills, interact with blind adult mentors, and enjoy field trips to sites related to the NFB Bell Academy curriculum. Arizona's NFB Bell Academy will run from May 26 through June 6, 2025, daily from 8:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Lunch will be provided and there is no registration fee. Transportation can be arranged upon request. The registration deadline is May 16. For more information, please contact Bell Coordinator Samaya Terran by phone at 480-309-9393 or by email starin@savvy.us. Extended School Year, ESY. We have extended summer opportunities to students in the Maricopa County area. We will support your students in maintaining all the skills they learned during the school year and even get a head start at conquering all their future academic and blindness-related goals. ESY will be taking place Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., June 9th to June 27th, 2025. Ready, set, go! Our annual summer camp in Tucson offers blind and low-vision high school and college-bound students from anywhere in the nation an enriching experience that will help to prepare them for a future without limits. RSG takes place between June 8th through as late as August 2nd, 2025, depending on your schedule preference. The Genius Program. We are excited to offer a brand new week-long overnight camp for middle school-aged children, 11 to 15. This is a residential program based in Phoenix, and we can assist with transportation as needed. In this program, we will engage your student in hands-on activities across the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields. Genius will be taking place June 22nd through June 28th, 2025. This next piece comes from the Washington Post. It's by Lena S. Wen, and it's entitled, "Yes, Even Kids Profoundly Affected by Autism Can Thrive." It was published May 6th, 2025. Children with severe disabilities can learn with dignity. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., in response to backlash regarding his inaccurate statements about the tragedy of autism, clarified that he was only referring to children with profound autism. It is these kids who, as the Health and Human Services Secretary put it, will never hold jobs, write poetry, or use the bathroom unassisted. He's still wrong. Children with significant disabilities can thrive with dignity if provided the learning environment and resources they need. Last week, I had the privilege of visiting St. Elizabeth School in Baltimore, which serves children profoundly affected by autism and other conditions, including intellectual disabilities and traumatic brain injury. The school is non-public, which in Maryland means it operates independently but receives public funding to provide special education. Students who attend are referred there from public schools that cannot meet their needs. Michael Thorne, St. Elizabeth's executive director, told me students come from 10 different counties. Some travel as far as 2 hours each way. They can be admitted at any point between 1st and 12th grade and can remain enrolled until they are 21 in case they need extra time to complete their high school degree. That's right. Many students are working toward a diploma just like neurotypical schools. St. Elizabeth follows the curriculum of each student's home school system. Many will graduate, and those who do not work toward a certificate program. In some ways, a typical day at St. Elizabeth is no different from other schools. Students start with homeroom. They have 7 periods in which they go to classes for different subjects. In between, they have lunch in the cafeteria. At the end of the day, they head back to homeroom. In other ways, the experience is very different. Class sizes are small and never exceed 9 students. Most classrooms have 3 teaching staff to provide individualized and small group instruction. Dozens of specialists also assist students throughout the day. An occupational therapist might help a child with fine motor skills, and a speech-language pathologist might guide them on enunciation. Many students use wheelchairs and walkers. Children who are nonverbal use technology to help them communicate. Some students require one-on-one care. For instance, a child with complex medical needs may need a nurse to administer medications through a feeding tube. A student who engages in self-injuring behavior may have someone with them for safety. The school also employs behavioral support staff who specialize in de-escalation when children are in crisis. A key part of the school's mission is to prepare students for independence. Students receive constant hands-on instruction in life skills, such as making their bed and running laundry machines, which are emphasized throughout the day. For instance, some children haven't mastered brushing their teeth. So we'll teach them, Thorne said. There are sinks in the classroom. Another program allows students to leave campus and learn to buy groceries and order at a restaurant. A big focus is helping them use the bathroom independently. We have spent a lot of time and energy and fundraising dollars to get the school ready to be a good training site for independent toileting, he said. Starting from 9th grade, students and families work with a transition team to plan for life after St. Elizabeth. All high school students participate in a work-based learning program where they are assigned a job coach and perform weekly hands-on work such as preparing food, sorting mail, and operating a forklift. Upon graduation, many enter the workforce. A few go to college. Those with more significant needs are placed in adult learning centers. I was amazed by how attentive the school's staff is to the needs of the children and families they serve. Many autistic people have difficulty with temperature regulation and loud noises, so they constructed an indoor playground and provide quiet spaces and a sensory room. Some kids learn well through music and horticulture, so the school offers these dedicated programs. When I visited, a school band had just performed at a nursing home. Other students were selling plants they potted themselves to the staff and the community. We focus on what our students can do, not what they can't, Thorne said. Recognizing the intensive support students need, the school operates 11 months out of the year. When children with particular needs seek admission, Thorne tries to adjust staffing to accommodate them. Throughout our conversation, he emphasized the love his staff has for their students. A poignant example is when the school had to close early in the COVID-19 pandemic and families were desperate for care. Some staff took it upon themselves to go to students' homes, even at the risk of their own health. It's impossible to visit a school such as St. Elizabeth and not be moved by the remarkable people who work there. Their efforts are time and resource intensive, but they enable children with significant disabilities to learn, contribute, and thrive. They deserve our thanks, and their students deserve the same respect and dignity afforded to every member of society. Next up is a piece from the May edition of the Braille Monitor. It's entitled Crossing the Bay Bridge by Cassie McKinney. From the editor. A version of the following article originally appeared in the winter 2025 issue of Future Reflections, our sister publication for parents of blind children. Cassie McKinney is president of the National Organization of Parents of Blind Children, a division of the National Federation of the Blind. She writes about a fundraising activity that she and other members of the division undertook, participating in a 10K walk/run that crossed Maryland's Bay Bridge as a finale to a meeting of its board of directors. Here is what she says. As Federationists, we embark daily on endeavors to change misconceptions about blindness. Frequently, we cross metaphorical bridges that have been created between blind people and our dreams. On November 10, 2024, a group of Federationists joined more than 18,000 others in the physical challenge of a 10K walk that included crossing the 4-mile Bay Bridge in Maryland. Our participation in this event was spearheaded by the National Organization of Parents of Blind Children, NOPBC, and expanded to include other members of our Federation family. While its initial purpose was community involvement, the walk soon blossomed into a fundraising activity that helped support our organization. The dream of crossing the Bay Bridge started with a few of the parents who planned to be in Baltimore for the NOPBC board meeting. We wanted to take part in the event, which has become a wonderful way to showcase the magnificent bridge and the community support that it brings to the area it touches. Corrigan Sports is the company that has backed the walk/run since 2014. Over time, the event has grown, and more people take part every year. In 2024, the organizers anticipated that more than 18,000 people would be involved, both in person and virtually. Our team, the NFB Dreamers, was branded with our NFB mission statement in mind. Federationists walked to show the community that blind people can take part in the event and can do so on the same level as sighted participants. As parents, we walked for our blind children who face challenges in everything from education to extracurricular activities. For my part, I didn't just walk as a blind person or as the mom of my son Robert, who is blind. I walked for those parents and blind people who haven't found us yet, the ones who don't know that they can find a voice through the support system of the National Federation of the Blind. Our team did more than just walking. Through our participation, we raised money for the Federation. Our efforts brought in several thousand dollars in pledges from our supporters, which were matched through a generous donation from HumanWare. Our walking didn't just raise awareness for our Federation family. We were able to bring in the revenue that we need to fuel our work. Many people have asked me, what was it like to cross the Bay Bridge? Well, for me, the journey was full of emotion, a sense of triumph, self-awareness, accomplishment, endurance, and adversity. Let me begin with the adversity. The overwhelming sense of accomplishment was foremost in my mind as I completed a 10K for the first time in my life. However, I also experienced the physical pain that came from a foot injury that I did not know I had until the walk was completed. I have suffered from issues with plantar fasciitis for several years. While I participated in the walk, I assumed this condition was causing the pain I experienced. 2 days after the walk, I learned that the pain was actually caused by a stress fracture. In spite of the pain, I walked across the Bay Bridge with my white cane in my hand, putting one foot in front of the other. The passion that is in my heart for the work that we do in the Federation was the motivation and driving force that pushed me on. From time to time along the journey, I paused to stand by the railing of the bridge. All that my limited vision allowed me to see was the vastness of the Chesapeake Bay beneath us. My thoughts went to the endless numbers of people the Federation has not yet reached. My heart and my spirit were uplifted by our members who were supporting what we hoped to accomplish through this event. I knew that what we were doing was far more than crossing a bridge. Stepping across the finish line was one of the most emotional moments of this journey. Although I had finished the task at hand, it was a metaphorical beginning leading to the next bridge that will come. What will I be asked to do next to change the life of a parent in need, and how will I face that struggle with them? I know that this work of changing lives does not rest solely on my shoulders. It rests in the hearts of Federationists everywhere. The work we do will go on, and we will cross many more bridges, both physical and metaphorical. Indeed, members of the National Organization of Parents of Blind Children will cross the Bay Bridge again in 2025. We will take one step at a time, joined by others who are dreamers too. We will make a difference in the world we live in as blind people and as parents of blind children. The National Organization of Parents of Blind Children is proud to be a division of the National Federation of the Blind. We are devoted to finding more opportunities like the Bay Bridge Run, either as a division or in collaboration with our parent organization, through which we can bring in funds and be part of our communities. Stay tuned for information about efforts that are already in the works. When we take on challenges together, we share the love and philosophy at the heart of our movement. No matter how you are able to be out in your community, be active and push yourself in new ways. For many, this may not mean walking or running a 10K, and that's perfectly acceptable. Sometimes, it is in small ways that we have the greatest effect on changing the misconceptions about blindness. Always remember that you can achieve anything you put your mind to. You will do it by putting one foot in front of the other. Someday, you will be able to reflect on your accomplishment and see the bridges that you have crossed. Keep on dreaming. Now, here is an article from Modern Retina. It's entitled, May Declared as IRD and Genetic Testing Month. This is by Cassie Filkins, was published April 30th, 2025. Prevent Blindness has declared May the second annual Inherited Retinal Disease and Genetic Testing Month, offering free resources on education and other awareness efforts. Offering a variety of resources on inherited retinal disease, Prevent Blindness has declared the month of May as its second annual Inherited Retinal Disease, IRD, and Genetic Testing Month. IRDs are a group of diseases that can cause severe vision loss or even blindness, according to the press release. They are a genetic disorder caused by a change or variant in one or more genes that contribute to proper retinal functioning. IRDs include conditions such as cone rod dystrophy, Leber congenital amaurosis, retinitis pigmentosa, RP, and Stargardt disease. The organization's goal is to educate the public and allied health professionals on IRDs through education videos, web pages, and shareable social media graphics and fact sheets, available in both English and Spanish. New RD information sheets will be available on the website in May as well. Early detection and access to treatment is the key to preventing significant vision loss, including for inherited retinal diseases. And genetic testing may also save sight for patients and their families, Jeff Todd, President and CEO of Prevent Blindness, said. We encourage the public and health professionals to utilize our various free resources to learn more about IRDs, genetic testing, and steps to take today to save vision in the future. In addition to the month of May designated for IRD awareness, Prevent Blindness has also declared the third week of the month to the awareness and education of Stargardt disease. The organization is debuting its new Focus on Eye Health series episode, Stargardt Disease, a conversation with Brian and Bradford Manning of Two Blind Brothers. In this episode, Todd talks with both Brian and Bradford Manning, two brothers living with Stargardt disease. The three discuss the brothers' journey, offer advice to parents of children with the disease, and talk about Brian and Bradford's nonprofit founded to raise funds for the goal of curing blindness. Other resources for IRD offered by Prevent Blindness include two other episodes of the organization's Focus on Eye Health series, Stargardt Disease with Elias Trabulsi, MD, MED, pediatric ophthalmologist and geneticist, Department of Ophthalmology, Cleveland Clinic. Inherited Retinal Disorders and Genetic Testing with Alina V. Dumitrescu, MD, Clinical Associate Professor of Ophthalmology and Visual Sciences, Pediatric Ophthalmology and Strabismus, Inherited Eye Disease at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. IRD patient testimonials from Brenda Nykum, who is living with RP, and Maria Grazia Butita, who has cone dystrophy. Both patients discuss their individual lived experiences around their vision issues and their vision impairment journeys. Free webinar recordings, Inherited Retinal Diseases and Children's Vision and Eye Health, What You Need to Know, and Pathway to Diagnosis, Genetic Testing for Inherited Retinal Diseases, offered by the National Center for Children's Vision and Eye Health at Prevent Blindness. And now, from the Iowa Capital Dispatch, a commentary piece entitled, I Don't Want to Fix My Disability, I Want an Even Playing Field, by Maria Rapaz, published April 29, 2025. I have a developmental disability, ADHD, but no one would ever know unless I share that information. My invisibility makes disability skeptics and critics shockingly open about their bigotry. A former boss genuinely thought the whole point of the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, was to ensure people in wheelchairs could apply for jobs, not provide individual workplace accommodations. Long before the current administration was in office, the owner of a salon told me she would never hire anyone with a disability because she thought accommodations were a scam to increase her small business expenses. Lest you think the current harsh commentary of people with disabilities lies only on one side of the aisle, even my progressive family members are quietly ideologically aligned with today's attacks on the disability community. So when I read headlines about how the disability community is to blame for a plane crash, or how some of us should just die, I'm not surprised. Instead, I look at what is causing such unfounded panic. First, there are over 40 million of us with disabilities, and a bulk of them are over the age of 75. That's a lot of people to accommodate in individualized way, so perhaps such a task is too daunting, but we're not asking for the impossible. Second, there is a real fear that individualized accommodations could lead to an unfair advantage. What those complaints fail to acknowledge is that people with disabilities already begin with a significant disadvantage by merely having a disability. The world we live in was designed for neurotypical, able-bodied people and no one else. Third, the recent alarm is partially based on the idea that disability accommodations create reliance on external assistance while simultaneously diminishing the need for personal responsibility. Yes, we do rely on external assistance to be healthy and productive every day, in the same way a person requires glasses to see properly, or a person with diabetes needs insulin. Knowing your disability rights and asking for legally mandated accommodations is the epitome of personal responsibility and not letting a disability impede daily life. Rather than even a lopsided playing field, critics would rather fix us so we can conform to a neurotypical world or risk shutting us out altogether. Whipping the ADHD out of children is one of the latest suggestions. I have firsthand experience that this method doesn't work. but I don't want to be fixed because I'm not deficient, ashamed, or broken. People with disabilities are different, not better or worse or the same. What we want are basic human rights and dignity that include the ability to live up to our potential, fairly compete with our peers, be a productive and contributing member to society, and the opportunity to fully participate in everything life has to offer. A person living with paralysis from the waist down will never be able to walk up a flight of stairs in the same way I will never be an organized, focused student. These behaviors are a matter of skill, not will. If you think having a disability is a coveted status, try living with one every day in this country. Live long enough, and you eventually will. Let me remind you now that you're listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, John Curry. Next, from NBC News, new research contradicts RFK Jr.'s claim that severe autism cases are rising. Cases with mild or significant impairment stayed relatively consistent from 2000 to 2016, the analysis found, by Aria Bendix, published April 30, 2025. When Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced the government's new autism findings this month, he painted a grim and highly controversial picture. Not only was autism becoming more prevalent, he said, but most cases now are severe. The notion that severe symptoms are becoming more common isn't substantiated by scientific evidence. Rather, new research being announced this week at the annual meeting of the International Society for Autism Research in Seattle suggests that the share of autism cases with moderate or significant symptoms remained relatively consistent from 2000 to 2016. In the past few weeks, Kennedy has repeatedly referred to autism as an epidemic that is leading to more cases of severe intellectual disability. "This is an epidemic like nothing we've ever seen before. It dwarfs the COVID epidemic," he told Fox News this month. "This is disabling children for their entire lives." The characterization has sparked outcry among some parents, advocates, and medical experts who say Kennedy is using a minority of cases to represent autism as a whole. A recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that 1 in 31 children are diagnosed with autism by their 8th birthdays, but it didn't distinguish between cases with mild or severe symptoms. Kennedy estimated at an April 16 briefing announcing the findings that a quarter of children diagnosed with autism don't speak or use toilets without assistance. A previous CDC study found that nearly 27% of people with autism were nonverbal or minimally verbal or had IQs below 50. But many researchers believe the actual rate could be lower, and even then, not all cases have the same limitations. Autism is a spectrum disorder, meaning it can have a range of manifestations, some mild, others more pronounced, that affect how people socialize, communicate, learn, or behave. New research being shared this week found that only mild cases rose from 2000 to 2016. The analysis is based on data from the CDC's Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, which tracks autism cases across the United States. To determine whether cases were mild or not, the researchers looked at adaptive test scores, interviews that evaluate kids' social, communication, and daily living skills, as opposed to IQ scores, which illustrate intellectual disability. There are many kids with autism that have IQ scores that would define them as having intellectual disability, but their adaptive scores are higher, said a co-author of the research, Maureen Durkin, a professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. David Mandel, a psychiatry professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who wasn't involved in the analysis, said adaptive scores are designed to catch severe cases like the ones Kennedy described. Compared with IQ scores, they offer a better picture of how children with autism function in real life, he said, such as whether they can speak to others, dress themselves, or use the bathroom on their own. According to the analysis, 1.2 out of 1,000 children had autism with moderate or significant impairment in 2016, compared with 1.5 out of 1,000 in 2000. By contrast, mild cases rose 139% during that period, from 3.1 out of 1,000 to 7.3 out of 1,000. The increase is in kids who are less severely impaired. It would be really good if the current secretary of HHS knew that, said Marianne Barton, a clinical professor of psychological sciences at the University of Connecticut, who wasn't involved in the research. The Department of Health and Human Services didn't respond to a request for comment. One possible explanation for the rise in mild cases, Durkin said, is that doctors have gotten better at identifying mild symptoms. Developmental screenings became more common over the study period, and American Academy of Pediatrics began recommending universal screenings specifically for autism in 2006. The diagnostic criteria for autism also changed in 2013 to include milder cases, such as the condition formerly known as Asperger's. We are seeing the extraordinary expansion of the diagnostic criteria to include people who never would have met criteria for autism 50 years ago, Mandel said. Dr. Alex Kolevzan, clinical director of the Seaver Autism Center at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, said that since the analysis is based on health and school records rather than in-person diagnosis, it's possible it may include some children with mild symptoms who don't have autism at all. When you look at this group that we are probably pretty confident in the diagnosis, you're not seeing an increase in prevalence, he said. Kennedy has decried the theory, suggesting that only small slivers of rising cases are attributable to increased diagnosis. The media has bought into this industry canard, this mythology, that we're just seeing more autism because we're noticing it more, he told Fox News host Sean Hannity this month. Instead, Kennedy has said without evidence that an environmental toxin is driving up cases, and he tasked CDC scientists with identifying a catalyst by September, a feat outside researchers say is unrealistic unless the CDC already has a predetermined conclusion. Kolevzan said that it's possible that something in the environment could aggravate underlying genetic risks for autism, but that existing research hasn't pointed to any culprits yet. We're not going to discover some sort of widespread environmental factor that explains the increase in prevalence, he said. This next article comes from the Disability Scoop. The title, Television Academy Honors Disney Movie Starring Actress with Cerebral Palsy, by Sean Heasley, published May 2, 2025. A Disney movie about a sixth grader with cerebral palsy who's nonverbal and uses a wheelchair will receive a special honor from the people behind the Emmy Awards. Out of My Mind, which was released on Disney Plus last year, is one of six programs named to the Television Academy Honors this week. The awards are given annually by the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, the organization responsible for the Emmy Awards, to recognize programming that raises awareness about complex issues facing society. Out of My Mind stars Phoebe Ray Taylor, who has cerebral palsy herself, as Melody Brooks, a girl who's had limited opportunities because of her disability. When a young educator taps into Melody's potential, she starts to participate in mainstream schooling and rises to the occasion. The film features Melody using different augmentative and alternative communication systems, and the cast includes other actors with various disabilities. Jennifer Aniston portrays Melody's inner voice. In addition to Out of My Mind, the Television Academy honors will go to the Netflix documentary Daughters, National Geographic's Genius MLK/X, PBS's Independent Lens, Greener Pastures, the Paramount Plus documentary We Will Dance Again, and Will and Harper on Netflix. The programs selected explore such important issues, said Bobby Banks, a co-chair of the Television Academy Honors Selection Committee. The stories told, the voices heard, and the lives seen in these programs are a testament to the power of television to educate while entertaining and to inspire conversation, understanding, empathy, and, when needed, action. Now here's another piece from the Disability Scoop, this one entitled, Nation's Disability Services System Begins to Buckle as Funding Threats Intensify, by Michelle Diament, published May 5th, 2025. President Donald Trump wants to cut $163 billion in federal spending next year, potentially zeroing out key disability programs, some of which are already pausing services because they're running out of money. The White House unveiled a budget summary late last week, known as a skinny budget, that calls on Congress to slash funding for non-defense discretionary spending by 22.6% for the fiscal year starting in October. This would affect programs that Congress reauthorizes annually, but does not include mandatory programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. The summary offers little detail about how many disability programs would be impacted. However, a widely circulated budget document leaked last month from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services offers some clues. That document shows that the Trump administration wants to eliminate funding for protection and advocacy agencies, state councils on developmental disabilities, the Lifespan Respite Program, and university centers on developmental disabilities, among other programs, advocates say. The targeted disability programs are housed within the Administration for Community Living, which HHS said in March that it plans to break up. Jill Jacobs, executive director of the National Association of Councils on Developmental Disabilities, said she had hoped that Trump's skinny budget would allay concerns about the leaked HHS budget, but she indicated that it ended up doing just the opposite. It shows absolutely nothing about any Administration for Community Living, ACL, funding at all. Other operating divisions within HHS are identified, but there is nothing about disability, nothing about aging, nothing at all under the HHS category, Jacobs said. This makes things even more confusing and worrisome. Already, many developmental disability programs are being squeezed because HHS has delayed distributing funding that was authorized by Congress in March. In recent weeks, Disability Rights New Jersey, Disability Rights Mississippi, and Disability Rights Arkansas have announced that they would halt certain services, either temporarily or indefinitely, because they are running out of money. The groups are all federally mandated protection and advocacy organizations, or PNAs, which exist in each state to provide free legal and advocacy services to individuals with disabilities. The organizations help students with disabilities access school services, investigate abuse and neglect in both private and state-run facilities for those with developmental disabilities, and much more. Our agency has been serving individuals with disabilities since the early 1980s, and this is the first time that we have had to cease taking new cases agency-wide. Congress has already approved and allotted these monies for our agency. We just are waiting to receive it, said Polly Tribble, Executive Director of Disability Rights Mississippi. Our federal mandate is to protect and advocate for vulnerable people in Mississippi and to root out abuse, neglect, and exploitation. But without our promised funding, if someone calls tomorrow and needs assistance, we can only refer them to another agency. Tribble noted that the other agencies they refer to are also dealing with cuts and delays in federal funding. If this crisis is not resolved immediately, we are facing devastating layoffs that will severely compromise our ability to protect and serve the disability community, Tribble said. These organizations are not likely to be the last ones curtailing services, said Eric Buhlman, Deputy Executive Director for Public Policy at the National Disability Rights Network, an umbrella organization for PNAs across the country. Ultimately, all PNAs will be affected because they will run out of funding to pay for staff and services, he said. Representatives from HHS did not initially respond to questions about the payment delays, but the agency said on Monday that more than $1.1 billion in funding that Congress approved in March will be released by the Administration for Community Living in the next 2 weeks. The president's skinny budget spells out cuts at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Institutes of Health, among others. It seeks to consolidate housing assistance for people with disabilities with other programs and cut their funding. Spending on special education services would remain level per the plan, but 7 programs under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act would be consolidated to give states and school districts greater flexibility, and funding for the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights would be chopped by 35%. Level funding IDEA in particular, as proposed by the White House, is actually a cut, said Denise S. Marshall, CEO of the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates, or COPAA, a nonprofit that advocates for the rights of students with disabilities and their families. That's because funding has been static since 2023, even as the number of students with disabilities has grown, she said. The focus on cuts has advocates alarmed and programs operating in survival mode. All of the uncertainty around funding has meant that disability programs are having to spend precious time and resources on contingency planning instead of focusing on supporting people with disabilities and their families, said Allison Barkoff, a professor at George Washington University who led the Administration for Community Living under the Biden administration. Programs that are critical to people with disabilities and their families are at serious risk now and heading into the next fiscal year, she said, emphasizing that the risk has never been more serious. Our next article from the Disability Scoop is entitled, "To Improve Accessibility, Closed Captioning Gets an Overhaul," by Sean Heasley, published May 6, 2025. Closed captioning for television and movies has remained largely unchanged for decades, but a new design aims to give people with disabilities a better idea of what's happening on screen. Known as Caption with Intention, the system employs animation, color, and variable typography to give viewers who aren't hearing sound and dialogue a sense of emotion, tone, and pacing. The captioning system was developed by FCB Chicago, an advertising agency in partnership with the Chicago Hearing Society and the film company Rakish Entertainment. Those behind the technology said they worked with members of the deaf and hard of hearing community to refine the product in order to improve on deficits from traditional closed captioning in areas like speaker attribution, synchronization, and intonation. I grew up with two deaf parents, so we only watched captioned programming in our house. As someone who could hear, I could tell just how much was missing. Sarcasm, anger, joy, fear, all of it lost in plain white text, said Bruno Mazzotti, Executive Creative Director at FCB Chicago. That experience stayed with me my whole life. This project was a chance to finally close that gap, not just for my parents, but for millions of people like them. Caption with Intention is open source and freely available to any content creators, television or film studios, and streaming platforms. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences recently recognized Caption with Intention, supporting the technology as a new industry standard. And finally, a piece by Sean Heasley entitled Swim School's Launch Program for Kids with Autism, published April 29, 2025. Amid rising concern about drowning among children with autism, a new effort is underway to help kids with cognitive, physical, and developmental needs across the country learn to be safe in the water. Goldfish Swim School, which has 185 locations across 35 states and Canada, said it is introducing adaptive swim lessons through its Golden Learners program. Drowning remains the leading cause of unintentional injury death for children ages 1 through 4, and the second leading cause of injury death for children ages 5 through 14. With children with autism being 160 times more likely to drown, said Jenny McQuesten, co-founder of Goldfish Swim School. With a focus on developing water safety, swimming skills, and boosting self-esteem, the Golden Learners program is specially designed for kids who may need a little extra time, patience, and support, helping to remove barriers for families who may feel their child requires more individualized attention. Adaptive lessons feature consistent routines, sensory-friendly techniques, and focus on positive reinforcement, the company said. They will be offered one-on-one or in small groups, depending on each child's needs. The Golden Learners program has been in the works for years and was developed in consultation with a pediatrician and a pediatric occupational therapist, the swim school chain indicated. It is designed to offer kids with disabilities the ability to learn at their own pace. Last summer, there was an uptick in drownings of children with autism, prompting the National Autism Association and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to issue an urgent alert to remind first responders and others to check areas with water first whenever a child with autism goes missing. And that's the Disability News Program for this time. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. I thank you for tuning in. And I invite you to keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.